Hi, Sam Hawley here from ABC News Daily. The Queensland of the 1950s appeared to be a God-fearing and tough-on-crime kind of place, but peer below the surface and there was gambling, drugs and brothels kept in check by crooked cops. On Monday, we spoke with Matt Condon about his new podcast exploring this murky world. And today, we're bringing you a full episode of the Dig series, Sirens Are Coming. There's never before heard audio, exclusive access to some of the key undercover players and insights from more than a decade of Matt's reporting on Queensland police corruption. You can find the full season of Dig, Sirens Are Coming, right now on the ABC Listen app. And I'll be back with a new episode of ABC News Daily right here on Monday morning.
Hi, I'm Shane Anderson, one of the producers on this series. And I want to have a quick word on what you're about to hear. This series features the voices of sex workers and their historical testimonies. Occasionally, you'll hear them referred to as prostitutes. We just want to acknowledge here that there's a lot of debate around the use of this term. So going forward, when we talk about them, we'll be using the term sex worker out of respect to their experiences. This episode contains adult themes and references to alcohol and drug use.
How did you feel driving in the car?
Oh, a little bit nervy. A few memories. I've been nervy the last couple of days.
This is Dorothy Edith Knight. I'm meeting her in the same place she agreed to meet corrupt detective Glendon Patrick Hallahan in December 1971. It was here at Brisbane's New Farm Park she helped entrap Hallahan in a life-threatening sting. It was the moment that changed her life. She hasn't been back here since.
Just hope I don't break, and I won't.
Yeah. What were you thinking of?
In my wildest dreams, I didn't think I would be doing it. You know, like giving Hallahan up, I suppose you'd say. I probably told him things I never told anybody.
A young sex worker in Brisbane, Dorothy had been paying Hallahan weekly protection money for years. But their cosy arrangement and their friendship would end on this day. 50 years later, Dorothy shows me where they'd stationed a surveillance caravan and undercover cops to monitor the takedown.
That thing there, sitting there, and there was a lot of noise because all the police were here and they were mowing and
undercover.
All undercover.
Yeah.
The plan was simple. She'd hand over her regular payment of protection money and the undercovers would witness him take the cash. It was the first time Queensland police had used a wire in a sting.
It was a matchbox.
Yes.
And the cord went down there, bin, and they said to me, when you sit down and you've got, you know, had longer slacks on than these, don't move.
Yeah.
So I was conscious of that.
The wire drove home the danger of the whole covert operation. And given Hallahan's reputation for violence, Dorothy's life was on the line.
Yeah, the next thing I turned around and he was there. Glenn arrived. He said to me, you don't seem yourself today. Are you not well? I said, as a matter of fact, I haven't been well all night. I said, I've had a bad headache. And I was a bit stuttery, and I do get a bit stuttery when I get nervous. So he not asked me that once, he asked me that twice. He said, I think I should drive you home today. And I said, no, not at all.
Dorothy handed Hallahan the money, and when he walked off, the undercovers swooped.
But I wanted to turn around. I wanted to see what was going on with him. It was chaos. I'd give my right arm to know what was said, and the look on his face would have been amazing, wouldn't it?
That moment set off a siren call that's still wailing into the 21st century. A call from women like Dorothy, who for decades sustained the underworld empire of police corruption. Women who eventually brought that system to its knees. I'm journalist Matthew Condon, and this is Dig. Sirens are coming. I've been investigating historical crime and corruption in Queensland for more than 10 years. And I've collected hundreds of hours of audio recordings about this time. I've spoken with everyone from police to politicians, taxi drivers to doormen. And in all those hours of tape, I realised there were voices that have hardly ever been heard. Those voices belong to Queensland's underground sex workers.
I, at the time, assumed that all the police were sort of in on it, that they were being paid off and it was being protected.
Everybody knew it was happening and no one was doing anything about it.
She actually believed them to be her friends.
I never woke up for a long time that this man was keeping me for himself.
In his mind, there's no way that she would ever commit a suicide.
For the first time, we were hearing evidence from somebody who'd worked in the system.
Why have you never heard these stories? Because these women were marginalised, dismissed as being of low moral character, ignored and treated like objects. But they had an advantage. They were inside Queensland's corrupt machine. They were key to its survival, and if they had the courage, they could bring the whole system down. In this series, I'm revisiting unanswered questions from this era of police corruption. I'll retrace how one of these women died, another went missing, and a third is living her life in witness protection. And then there's a fourth, Dorothy Edith Knight, a friendly and frail woman who in her younger days stared down one of the biggest crooked cops in our criminal history.
It's just hard to imagine
that I'm still alive.
This is episode one, The Great Survivor.
Life is great in the Sunshine State. Every Queensland heart sings a song.
On the surface, the capital of the Sunshine State was unremarkable. It was a city of wood and corrugated iron houses, a place with one conservative post-war hand on the Bible and the other on vice and its ill-gotten cash.
From the northern Cane to the western plain, it's a full of promised land.
I grew up there in the 60s in a small faux colonial house in a suburb on the city's western fringe. We knew it was time to come home for dinner when the streetlights flickered on at dusk. To us, it felt like a safe place.
For friendship's great in the Sunshine State, may its sunshine keep smiling for you.
I tracked Dorothy down through a source after I heard about her involvement in the crooked cop Glenn Hallahan's sting. It took 2 years before she agreed to talk to me. A week later, I was standing in the garden of her country home, west of Brisbane, admiring the many native trees and flowers that she'd grown. She's in her late 70s now, but 50 years ago, she was young and vibrant and loved a good time. Dorothy has a huge laugh, especially after a glass of wine, and she calls a spade a spade. She's impulsive, quick-witted, and daring.
Did you get men that fell instantly in love and said, come with me and I'll change your life? And
I had one without a word of a lie. He lived with his mother. He's an older bloke. Oh, mate, he wanted me, and I'll tell you now, that bloke was not short on money, right? Anyway, he finished up, he died. I missed him too, and I missed his money.
Long before Dorothy got into sex work, or worked with police on that historic sting operation, she was a small-time hustler. And to get by in the mid-1960s, she was passing forged cheques at some well-known department stores.
I had to go to court, right, on a heck of amount of charges with these checks, and it's really quite a lot of money.
Dorothy spent a couple of months in jail in Brisbane. That's how she first met Glenn Hallahan.
Now, he came to visit me a few times when I was in there to tell me that when I come out, that they were going to take me straight to Victoria.
Dorothy may not have realised at the time, but this wasn't any ordinary officer singling her out in prison. Glendon Patrick Hallahan was one of three infamous coppers known as the Rat Pack.
The so-called Rat Pack, three men with controversial careers in the Queensland Police Force.
The Rat Pack ran a burgeoning vice game in Brisbane from the 1950s right through to the 1980s. Sex workers were central players in this system, which was known to those on the take as the joke. And the joke was enforced by a trio of detectives, Terry Lewis, Tony Murphy, and Glenn Hallahan.
Hallahan had a colourful career in the force. Police reporters liked him, and he was popular as a determined, some said brilliant, investigator.
Glendon Patrick Hallahan was the youngest Rat Pack member, and at the time, the most famous.
He first came to public prominence when, in his late 20s, he arrested a man in Mount Isa for the multiple sundown murder in Alice Springs. On Hallahan's evidence, the man went to the gallows in South Australia. But then the publicity Hallahan attracted was all bad.
Violent and ruthless, Hallahan was a man of few words. His nickname was Silent. I'm told his fists did the talking. Then, Tony Murphy.
Detective Sergeant Anthony Murphy, a popular investigator within the force.
Everyone called Murphy the boss and the grey ghost. He was smart and powerful, both physically and mentally. Former detective Abe Duncan worked alongside Murphy at the Central Intelligence Branch, or the CIB. He says the grey ghost had a photographic memory, which gave him an edge as a copper.
Well, he's one of the five best detectives that ever went through the CIB. Tremendously hard worker and dedicated detective he was.
And finally, Terence Murray Lewis.
The public is well aware of the background of Terence Murray Lewis, who rose under controversial circumstances from a small town inspector to become Commissioner of Police.
Lewis had the charm of a used car salesman. He was meticulous in everything he did. He was the observer, the organiser, the man who cooked the books. A former colleague of his remarked, if Murphy and Hallahan were meat eaters, Lewis was a grass eater.
He was very, very, very particular and a very, very tidy man. If you went into his locker in the CIB, it'd be really conspicuously clean, you know.
And with the burly police commissioner, Frank Bischoff, known to everyone as the big fella leading the pack, they were a force to be reckoned with.
Are you ready?
Yeah, absolutely. My producer, Shane Anderson, and I have been spending hours, days, delving into my archive of tapes. We're in different cities, in different states, so we often chat from our home studios. So, Shane, let's take a closer look at Glenn Hallahan and how his relationship with Dorothy began. At the time he meets Dorothy, when she's in jail on those fraud charges, he's a senior detective, but he's also a big player in the underground vice game.
So this might seem really weird, a high-ranking policeman personally going into jail to visit a check forger like Dorothy, but actually Hallahan was known for this.
Yeah, and it actually goes to the heart of the malevolence of these men, these police officers. Hallahan is one of Queensland's most famous and successful detectives. This guy deals in murder, break and enter, manslaughter, robbery, the toughest of crimes. Why on earth does he have an interest in this blonde young woman in jail who's been nicked for bouncing a few checks. Dorothy was a target for them, for Hallahan, to potentially make money off. These men are predators, number one predators, and they would see this woman in jail, vulnerable, and they would go in and make friends. You know, it's incredibly powerful to have a police officer who is showing interest in you and is giving you advice and potentially could help you on the outside.
Yeah, and it speaks to these two really distinct faces that Hallahan has, right? So he's like this really charming, handsome guy that women like Dorothy can't help but fall for. But it doesn't quite gel with what we know about Hallahan in the historical record, which is that he had this really violent, sadistic side as well.
Yes, there were two Hallahans, without question. One, very debonair, tall, handsome, reeked of cologne. On the other hand, he was utterly cold and calculated. Hallahan was only about Glenn Hallahan. But it was not what he showed people like Dorothy.
And the only reason he could walk around bathed in cologne was because of the kickbacks he was getting from women like Dorothy.
Exactly. And you will hear over and over again, hundreds of times I heard from honest police officers, and they said, you can always pick the corrupt officer. He could afford these clothes because he was taking money from all these women that he had lured into his stable. Dorothy spent more time in jail in Melbourne on fraud charges before she was released and went to live with her family.
I got a job in Bentley in Victoria. I wasn't there too long. I was on a machine that, you remember when Glad Wrap and all that sort of stuff started to come out? Yes. Well, I was on a machine that used to make that. The money wasn't too bad, actually, because I was living at home.
But Dorothy soon found a job with better pay, sex work. She got a taste for a life of money and glamour and bid farewell to the Glad Wrap and then Melbourne itself. She returned to the Sunshine State and reconnected with the one copper she knew in Brisbane, Glenn Hallahan.
I rang Glenn and I told him, Glenn, I said, I'm in Queensland. And I said, I've been doing a little bit of prostitution work in Melbourne. He said, oh, have you? What brought you into that? And I said, oh, I don't know, probably out of desperation or whatever. He said, I'd like to see you. I'd like to talk to you.
She met Hallahan for drinks at the National, and he filled her in on how the corrupt system they called the joke actually worked. The National, or the Nash, as the locals called it, was perched on the corner of two major city streets. It was an old multi-storey pub that enjoyed a view of the Brisbane River.
And he said, you do know that somebody will catch up with you along the line and you'll have to pay some money. And I said, oh, yes, I understand that.
The National already had a seedy reputation, and it was the favourite watering hole for police.
Word got around, you see. If you wanted a girl, well, go to the National.
Dorothy worked out of the National's many bars from the 1960s onwards.
Before I went to work, I often think about, I think, Jesus, I used to spend so long in that bloody bedroom getting myself ready. And I even had a special makeup light thing. I paid a lot of money for it. Because I'm short, I'd wear very high heels. And I had very long hair. I was very, very fussy about my hair. And I would just present myself at the bar and I drank scotch.
Scotch helped smooth out a night's work. But as Dorothy told me, sometimes she needed a little more.
There was a thing getting around called Purple Hearts.
Purple Hearts were popular stimulants in London's nightclub districts during the early to mid-1960s, and eventually they turned up in Australia.
If I was feeling a bit down, once you had half of that and a scotch, you were over the moon.
Potential clients met her at the bar.
And then they'd suss me out at the hotel, and then they'd buy you a drink, and the next thing, you know, say, oh, you know, how are you going tonight? Can we do something? And that's how it would work.
When she'd secured a client, they'd go upstairs to the pub's guest rooms.
$50 to $80 was the going rate in those days for the whole thing. On a good night, I'd have, say, five. I didn't get five all the time. One of the reasons I went to the National Hotel is that I knew the only person I had to pay was Glenn.
Glendon Patrick Callahan. He and the rest of the Rat Pack revelled in the National's hospitality. When I think about who could really give a snapshot of what the force was like at the time, Ron Eddington is the first name that springs to mind. He worked alongside the Rat Pack and wasn't ashamed to admit he was also on the take.
It was accepted, and we didn't think, anything about it. The only years that when someone tried to put a bit of shit on you, you put a bit of shit on him.
Ronnie Eddington loved a chat. In fact, some in the press called him the Foghorn, a police rent-a-quote, especially during the years he headed up the powerful police union.
Murphy, Allahan and Lewis, we always worked in pairs, but they worked, the three of them, together all the time.
He said there were different times.
Detectives in those days were only bloody playboys. We'd go to work and it was like a day out. You weren't going to work, you're going to day out. You could go into the pubs and drink. You'd never get chastised. Whatever you wanted to do, you could do. Didn't have to go there and ask for permission to do this or do that.
Ron Eddington and other police I've spoken to from that time have told me of a Rat Pack reign over sex workers that involved heavy surveillance. Dorothy and her contemporaries were subject to all this. She would have faced weekly check-ins and interrogation. She couldn't work anywhere else or with anyone else, and she had to pay weekly protection money. All the city's sex workers did the same. Dorothy Edith Knight often met and drank with Glenn Hallahan at the National. She was paying him at least $20 a week for so-called protection. That's more than $300 today.
And for your money, what did Hallahan give you in exchange? What was the money for? Was he supposed to protect you?
Well, he was looking after me.
In what way, shape or form? Is that in not getting charged or not?
Yes, not getting charged. I was protected well and truly.
Do you think, looking back, that Hallahan, well, he saw you as his property?
Oh, yes, definitely. I was, and really, so was Shirley Briffman.
Shirley Briffman. The ghost that for 50 years has haunted every facet of this story. If you're investigating crime and corruption in Queensland, you cannot escape Shirley. Like Dorothy, Shirley also worked the bars and restaurants of the Nash, but in the earlier years.
I'd give my right arm to know her. Couldn't her and I had some talks.
Vivacious and charismatic, she rose from the backstreet parlours of Brisbane to become queen of the Sydney madams. She was intimate with the worst corrupt coppers and the biggest gangsters. She had the ear of police commissioners. She was a favourite of the Rat Pack. To understand how Shirley Briffman ended up where she did, I wanted to go back to where it all began. She grew up in a small farming town, Atherton, in far north Queensland in the late 1930s and 40s. Her father and brothers scratched out a living as timber workers and labourers. And in her teens, Shirley was a social butterfly, travelling for hours to attend debutante balls. I tracked down some old family friends from Atherton. They remember her as attractive and full of life.
We used to go to football and dancing, but she you never saw her without makeup on. Her mother was like that. She was always well dressed. She was quite popular, but always friendly. Had a lovely smile. But didn't she get into some trouble in later years?
Yes, she did.
That trouble had a name, and it was Sammer Sonny Briffman, the man Shirley married. Sonny was a concern to Shirley's family because his first wife had died suddenly, and there were rumours he'd had a hand in her death. Soon after Sonny and Shirley started hooking up, Shirley's life took a major turn, and the reason for this shift remains a bit of a mystery to me. She went from working as a barmaid in Cairns to moving to Brisbane and entering a new and dangerous era as a sex worker. where she ended up alongside Dorothy at the National Hotel. Shirley and Dorothy were both deeply entangled with the Rat Pack, and the National Hotel was the centre of their worlds. As for the big fella, Police Commissioner Frank Bischoff, he was a regular. That's right. I've been told the police commissioner was often there, rubbing shoulders with sex workers. He'd regularly have lunch with the hotel owners, and Bischoff's lunches would often spill into the evening. Did you ever see him in there?
I did see him. I didn't have anything to do with him, but I did see him, and I've seen him a couple of times.
The Rat Pack and Frank Bischoff partied hard. It became conspicuous to some of the city's more upstanding citizens. People like Colin Bennett, a lawyer who was well known for fighting for social justice. Colin Bennett did a lot of pro bono work for those who'd been pushed to the fringe of a conservative society, Aboriginal people, the homeless, and sex workers. He was an occasional lawyer to Shirley, and he had proof of the Rat Pack's dirty ways.
In fact, Dad even had a photo of Frank Bischoff in the National Hotel in his police gear.
Really?
With Briffman sitting on his knee.
You're kidding?
Yeah.
This is one of Bennett's daughters, Mary. She told me some of her father's memories after he died in 2002. She said it was Shirley who gave Colin Bennett that photo.
Dad said that copper on the street was fine. Good blokes did their work well. But the CI branch was from the top to the bottom, totally corrupt.
Mm.
His daughters say Bennett kept close tabs on the Rat Pack's involvement at the National Hotel.
Because he was just appalled.
And when Colin Bennett was elected to state parliament in 1960, he decided to strike. It's 4:27 p.m. on Tuesday, the 29th of October, 1963. Colin Bennett, the now Labour member for South Brisbane, stands to address the chamber during a dreary debate on supply.
I propose to concentrate my attention on the police department and the police force of Queensland.
He points out the elephant in the room, police corruption, and he tells the government to do something about it.
The Commissioner and his colleagues who frequent the National Hotel, encouraging and condoning the call girl service that operates there, would be better occupied in preventing such activities rather than tolerating them.
Suddenly, all eyes were on women like Shirley and Dorothy. Within 2 weeks, the Premier Frank Nicklin announced a royal commission that would become known as the National Hotel Inquiry. It was Queensland's first ever royal commission into police misconduct. Dorothy wasn't called to the witness stand in the National Hotel Inquiry, but Shirley was. It was in late January 1964, and she was the star of the show. The Rat Pack's future was in her hands.
So, Matt, that actual day and that interrogation in the courtroom, we don't actually have the transcript of what happened.
At some point, a government non-publication order was lowered over the entire transcript of the National Hotel Inquiry, and that non-publication order was marked as 100 years.
But we do have some excerpts of the transcripts from that day that made their way into some other police files that we do have access to. So what we can do is recreate those moments with the exact questions and answers that were posed to Shirley that afternoon.
Yeah, so let's do this. So Shane, I want you to be Shirley Briffman. So I'm going to ask you that first question to Ms. Briffman. Do you want to say whether you have ever been a prostitute since 1958?
All right, so Shirley says in response to this, I have never been a prostitute. Well, Matt, that's a lie.
Quite incredible to have the guts to commit an act of gross perjury right off the bat.
What's the next question?
Okay, Ms. Briffman,
how do you come to know members of the consorting squad?
So the consorting squad, that's like the Rat Pack, right? Lewis, Hallahan, Murphy?
Correct.
Shirley replies, they used to pull me out of the Grand Central Hotel.
That was another dive, if you like the National.
There is a follow-up question here too. They ask Shirley, is that the only way you know them? Shirley says, that is correct.
So the next question to Shirley on the stand is, have you ever had a drink at the National Hotel in Brisbane?
Maybe once in 6 months. That is about all.
I imagine some stifled laughter in that courtroom. Shirley was a consistent and conspicuous presence in the National Hotel during that period.
And then there's what she says about a Mr. David Young.
Yes, David Young. Well, he was a civilian. He used to work at the National. And, you know, the poor fellow was trying to do the right thing and come forward to the inquiry and give evidence of what he'd seen when he worked at the National and stuff. So you'd think a credible witness. So David Young is called.
So they figure they'll put David Young's evidence to Shirley, starting with the basics.
Yes. Was he acquainted with you, Shirley Briffman? That's the question. Acquainted with her.
Yep. And so Shirley replies to this, like, yeah, he was acquainted with me.
Were you on best of terms with David Young? And were you also very good friends, besides being acquainted?
Yeah, and Shirley elaborates. So she says, you know, yes, I did know David Young outside of being a waiter and a night porter. He was a very good friend. He knew everything about me. And then she says, I was pregnant at one stage and he performed an abortion on me in a flat at New Farm.
Okay, so let's just stop right here and take that in. It's impossible to appreciate now, conservative Brisbane, 1964, to hear this enunciated in a public court would have been nothing short of shocking.
It is a huge bombshell, and it is just a complete assassination of David Young's character.
Yeah, this was a total setup, including the false allegation that David Young had committed an abortion on her. He was finished from that moment. His reputation was dirt from that moment on. It's one of the side tragedies of this case.
And we do know that later on, Shirley would be interviewed about what happened in the court this day, and she would reveal years later everything that was going on behind the scenes of this afternoon in court.
But we're not there yet. Justice Gibbs said in his final report, to sum the matter up, there is no acceptable evidence that any member of the police force was guilty of misconduct or neglect or violation of duty in relation to the policing of the hotel. Why did Shirley take the enormous risk of committing perjury? Whatever the reason, she'd been loyal. She'd stayed staunch. Dorothy also stayed in line, and after the inquiry, she continued her arrangement with Glenn Hallahan at the National Hotel. Bischoff and his Rat Pack had outsmarted a royal commission. They threw a victory party. And where do you think they held it? At the National Hotel. In the next episode, Shirley moves south to the bright lights of Sydney and gets entangled in its underworld of corrupt cops and hardened gangsters. And she's warned by a Sydney detective that her life depends on her loyalty. Meanwhile, Dorothy Edith Knight will risk everything to take down a member of the Rat Pack. In this series, you'll hear how, in deciding to push back, women like Shirley and Dorothy were punished. How they were failed by police, both corrupt and straight, and how they were caught in a system where there were no winners.
I really would like to be heard. I would really like somebody to say, well, you know, she did do the right thing. She tried hard and she suffered for it.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Wurundjeri, Kaurna, Turrbal, Bundjalung and Gadigal people. The series is reported and written by me, Matthew Condon, and Shane Anderson. Emma Masters is our supervising producer, and Claire Rawlinson is our executive producer. extra production and fact-checking by Jim Malo and Phoebe Hosier. Sophie Townsend and Michael Delaney are our script editors. Original music by Hamish Camilleri, sound design and mixing by Simon Branthwaite. Adam Steer, Amy Kersey and Steve Anderson were voice actors in this episode. Thanks to Radio National and ABC Audio Studios' Kath Dwyer and Justine Kelly. This podcast includes interviews I recorded for my book series Three Crooked Kings, which tells the history of Queensland police corruption. My thanks to my publisher, Madonna Duffy at University of Queensland Press, for her continued support. And a very special thank you to Dorothy Edith Knight for sharing her story with us.